Morning Coffee with Mel is a production of the Epic with Mel Media Group, copyright 2021, all rights reserved.
Welcome, welcome to the Morning Coffee with Mel on MixLR Radio. Hope you guys are having a great morning today. It's a chilly 36 degrees here in Tennessee where we're at. And yes, it is. I love this weather. So today's show, I am going to be talking about favorite foods in each state. This is really interesting to me when I was looking at these. I was a little surprised about some of these states and what they had to choose for their favorite dish. Tennessee in particular, but we'll get there. So we're gonna start with the great state of Alabama, and their favorite seems to be the Southern tomato pie. Now, I've never had tomato pie. I know this goes back for forever, and I'm sure I would love it. It says that they have a special attachment to this dish. Most culinary experts trace the delectable tomato pie roots to a recipe featured in a magazine in the late 70s. To make it, the chefs lined a pie crust with a combination of garden fresh tomatoes, chopped green onions, garlic, and basil, and then they top it with a mixture of cheese and mayonnaise. Some prefer Valdea onions added to the cheese mixture. Each cook then bakes slices and serves this flavorful concoction as a side dish on its own or with a green salad. Sounds really good to me, but I'm a huge tomato pie fan. I know my husband sitting here is not the biggest tomato fan. He'll eat it sometimes, but this would probably be a dish for me. So now we're going to go on to Alaska. And I'm sure you can probably guess what Alaska's specialty would include. Their specialty, it seems, or their favorite, should I say, is smoked salmon. So cold water seafood is a staple in Alaska. And of course, you can guess that. I can guess that. Anybody can guess that. And there are 5 different species of salmon available year-round. Chum, sockeye, king, silver, and pink. Around 90% of the wild salmon harvested in the U.S. comes from Alaska. One of the top ways to serve salmon across the state is to smoke it in a smoker. Most cooks keep seasoning simple, using salt and pepper or a homemade seasoning blend. They wrap it in foil and leave an open section to allow the smoke flavor to permeate the fish. Others prefer to use a thin glaze of mayonnaise spread across the salmon, adding a layer of onions before wrapping it and smoking it on the grill. I personally love salmon. I really do. Particularly smoked. I think it's wonderful. I've actually made it at home on an oak slab, and a cedar is what I've used. Yeah, cedar slab, and it's delicious. It gives such a great flavor, especially on the grill. I would recommend anybody who likes salmon to try that. You can get them, the cedar planks, you can actually get at Home Depot, believe it or not, and they're food grade, and they're a lot less expensive than buying them in the specialty stores or at the regular store, because I guess nobody thinks to buy them at Home Depot or Lowe's. But they are the cedar planks are a lot less expensive there. So I highly recommend the preparation of salmon that way on the grill on that cedar plank. So now we're going to go to Arizona. Their specialty is chimichangas. I'm a big fan of chimichangas.
Me too.
Yep, my husband is too.
My favorite.
Legends about the origins of this popular fusion of Mexican and American cuisines differ. But many Arizonans say the chimichanga was first created in Tucson's oldest restaurant, El Charro, in 1922.
Wow.
Its name originally was a nonsense word in Spanish, translated to a whatchamacallit. And of course, that whatchamacallit's one of my favorite candy bars. So, or a thingamajig, they call it as well. Tucson recipes describe the chimichanga as a flour tortilla, overstuffed with steak or chicken, vegetables and spices, wrapped and then deep fried. Most kitchens serve chimichangas in the traditional way, on a plate, over a bed of mildly spicy red sauce, and covered in cheese.
Anything covered in cheese is good.
Yes, and I love a chimichanga, that's for sure. So we're going to go to Arkansas now. Arkansas is biscuits and chocolate gravy. I have to say, I've heard of this, but I don't know. I mean, I'm willing to try just about anything, so I would probably try it, but I don't know that this would be a dish for me. Few old recipe boxes in Arkansas don't feature a handwritten version of instructions for creating this traditional dish. Many who grew up in Arkansas finally remember the eating of the chocolate gravy slathered over a hot, freshly prepared biscuit on Saturday morning. The recipe's popularity dates back to the Civil War era. Throughout the Ozark and Appalachian Mountains, ingredients may vary, but cooks originally created chocolate gravy using margarine or oleo, flour, sugar, milk, and cocoa powder.
I think we have to try that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like I said, I'm willing to try anything, and I make a darn good biscuit, so we'll have to see about this. Maybe as a dessert, even.
That would be interesting.
Yes. So now we're going to go to California, where we have the Cobb salad. Now, I am a huge salad fan. I love salads. Love them. I don't eat enough of them, but I do love them. As one of the most diverse states in the country, California offers rich gastronomy. Origin stories differ, but most say that the ever-popular Cobb salad was first created by accident in the 1930s at the famous Hollywood Brown Derby restaurant. That restaurant, I think, is known everywhere. I would love to go just to visit the Brown Derby restaurant. My son actually graduated from Coast Guard school that he's doing now, which is a storekeeper. That's his job in the Coast Guard. And he graduated school there in California. Petaluma was where the actual school was. And I had never been to California before I went to his graduation. Now, Petaluma, I fell in love with. Anybody who's been there knows Petaluma is a lots and lots of farmland. I'm a country girl down to my soul, so that was beautiful country to me. Now, I can tell you, most of the Coast Guard kids that were going to school didn't like it because it was all farmland. Now, we did take a drive into San Francisco. I didn't care for San Francisco, but it's because I don't like big cities. I don't like the big crowds. We did go and see Alcatraz, and that was very, very interesting. That was something to see, and if you ever make it out of California, I would say that you should go see Alcatraz. It's awesome, awesome place to visit. But as for the rest of it, it's just not my thing. I know there's tons and tons of people that live there, tons and tons of people that love California and the big cities, but I'm definitely a country girl, so if I were to go and stay, Petaluma, at least right now, from what I've seen, is probably where I'd want to go. So anyway, we'll move on. The owner of the Brown Derby, Robert Codd, looking for something to eat late one night, threw together some lettuce, fresh tomato, onion, hard-boiled egg slices, and avocados, and then topped it off with blue cheese and crisp bacon pieces. He tossed the mixture with some French dressing, and a legendary salad dish was born. Yep, I would definitely eat that up. Now we're going to go to Colorado, and this would be my hubby's favorite.
Yep, I'm in already.
Yes, and their favorite is elk sausage. One of the great sources of pride for Coloradans is their magnificent mountain vistas, outdoor recreational activities, and amazing wildlife. Elk sausage, one of the most popular dishes in Colorado, is available in local restaurants and homes alike. Many locals compare its tender quality to high-quality beef, but say it's even more flavorful. Some cooks add jalapenos to the ground elk meat before shaping the sausage, then toss it on the grill to bring out its juicy, aromatic flavors. Now, I have to tell you, my husband loves elk burgers.
Yes,
he likes buffalo burgers. I'm not a big fan of the burger myself because I personally think it's a little dry, but it's because that meat is so lean, you really don't find fat in that meat. So to me, it's dry, but I know it's a very popular thing. Now, the sausage may be a little different. There may be some fat in there. Either they add the fat or somehow fat comes about because it's sausage. So I have to believe it's got to be fatty. But I would try that and I'd probably like it the way it talks about it being juicy. So now we're going to go on to Connecticut. And by the way, any of these states we're talking about, please feel free to call in and comment. Or you can text, and the phone number you would use is 865-383-8347. So here we go. We're going to go to Connecticut. Now, their favorite is white clam pizza. That's kind of odd to me, a clam pizza. I never even would have thought of it. This historic pizza was originated in New Haven in 1925 in a restaurant called Frank Pepe Pizzeria, Napolitana, one of the oldest pizzerias in America. The original recipe was a style called, let's see if I can pronounce this, a pizza. And pronounced a beets, actually. Isn't that funny? It was called a pizza, A-P-I-Z-Z-A, and pronounced a beets, A-B-E-E-T-S. That's very different. Like the original, white clam pizza still features Romano cheeses, olive oil, garlic, parsley, and freshly shucked clams laid out across a chewy crust, then baked on a coal-fired brick oven. New Haven was home to thousands of Italian immigrants in the early 1900s, making it the state's largest Italian colony, which I had no idea of that. So now we're going to go to Delaware. Delaware's favorite is blue crabs. The people of Delaware take their blue crab population seriously. Unlike other ocean-harvested seafood in surrounding states, the stock of blue crabs harvested from Delaware Bay is doing well. Blue crabs are a social event in Delaware and deeply embedded in the local culture. Families traditionally gather around a table with a bushel of crabs and crack them open for a shared meal. Locals dip the succulent, juicy crab meat in melted butter or a special sauce. One of these sauces originated in a local Wilmington restaurant and features a mixture of white vinegar, ketchup, sugar, chili powder, and Louisiana hot sauce. Woo!
Hard to beat a crab, yes, or lobster.
That's right. Yeah, lobster is probably my favorite. It's rare that we get to have it. It's so expensive, but I do love lobster. So now we're going to go to my home state. This is where I was actually raised, Florida. And this doesn't surprise me at all. Their favorite is key lime pie.
My favorite too.
Yes. Now, I normally do not like lime. I don't like lime flavored anything. I may take a little squirt of lime in my salsa or on a dish, but in general, lime flavor I do not care for. But I have to tell you, key lime pie I absolutely love. There is something different about the key lime versus a regular lime. Definitely a different flavor. We're pretty fortunate here because we have a store called Publix, which I know the Floridians know really well, and they actually carry key lime juice. So when I make a key lime pie, that's exactly what I buy, is that key lime juice, because it definitely has that key lime flavor that a regular lime does not have. Because I can tell you now, I would not eat regular lime pie. Nope, not for me. So it says food historians say the origins of the key lime pie began in the Key West area in the early 20th century. Restaurants around the state all serve a version of this dessert. The original recipe calls for sweetened condensed milk, egg yolks, and key lime juice for filling. Some purists say that the traditional key lime pie must have a meringue topping. Now, I'm not a big meringue fan either, but others insist that the pie be crowned with whipped cream. That's for me right there. And there are those who say there should be no topping at all. Topping or not, yeah, you like it plain with nothing else.
Yep.
Topping or not, it is a classic Florida dessert. So now we're going to go to Georgia. To me, that's the peanut state, but their favorite is Brunswick stew. Although other states claim to have the best version, Georgia has a long history with the traditional Brunswick stew, dating back to the 1800s. Cooks threw together just about any type of wild game that was available, including rabbits and squirrels.
Yeah.
Today, most people prefer adding chicken and pork, either purchased from a local smokehouse or prepared in their smoker at home. Vegetables include butter beans, corn, and tomatoes. Some cooks add secret ingredients such as potatoes or barbecue sauce. Recipes say the stew sauce isn't ready until it's very thick, which generally requires simmering for a few hours.
I wouldn't think potatoes would be a secret ingredient.
I don't know about that. I would probably put potatoes in mine.
I did almost buy a rabbit at the store yesterday.
Oh, gosh.
Why?
Well, I would try it. I can say that. I've never had rabbit, but I would try it.
They didn't have any squirrels, but
yeah.
They did have rabbit.
Yeah, squirrels are out. Actually, we don't see squirrels around here, but we live on a farm. Yeah, we live on a farm, so we really don't see many squirrels.
It's not wooded enough.
No. So now we're going to go to Hawaii. And Hawaii's dish is called saimon. Decades before Hawaii became a state, American businesses controlled the islands and operated huge fruit and sugar plantations there. Scores of Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, Portuguese, and African laborers landed on the island to work on these plantations. Their presence led to an evolution of traditional Hawaiian foods. Sammy is a Chinese egg noodle soup originating from the plantation era. Later, Japanese cook added flavors to the dish, including dashi broth, which I have no idea what dashi broth is. Other unique flavors and ingredients reflected the ethnic heritage of those who lived and worked on the island. Today, Hawaiians describe sammy as a traditional local dish. It's available everywhere, even at McDonald's in Hawaii.
That's interesting. Wow.
Very odd. So we're going to go to Idaho, which we're going to find the huckleberry pie to be their favorite.
Made huckleberry wine once.
Oh, I would love to try the huckleberry pie. I can tell you. It looks good in the picture on the internet. Huckleberry pie is a small, delicious fruit that grows in the U.S. It's also a term Americans use to describe something small or insignificant.
I'm your huckleberry.
Yeah. Literally, scholars believe the berry was the inspiration for Mark Twain when he named his Huckleberry Finn character. Idahoans say the flavor of the huckleberry are anything but insignificant, so they choose it as their official state fruit. Commercial growers don't grow huckleberries. Pickers head to the secret spots to harvest the berries each year during the short picking season. Huckleberry pie is a favorite tradition and the delicious results of successful harvest. Some bakers add a pinch of cinnamon, others toss in some orange zest or orange juice to the huckleberry mixture. It's surprising they don't have it commercially grown.
That's surprising.
I wonder what that is. Maybe the crops are just too small. I don't know. I just wonder why they don't commercially grow it.
I'm going to have to research that and find out why.
Yeah, me too. Mm. So in Illinois, we have something interesting called the horseshoe sandwich. I have never heard of this, but of course I've never been to Illinois. This iconic open-faced sandwich originally includes slices of ham. Cooks took slices from bone-in hams and then served them on sandwiches on a sizzling metal plate. Through the years, they substituted the ham for other meats like chicken or hamburger, but the rest of the requirements for a traditional horseshoe sandwich have stuck to the original recipe. A pile of French fries sits on layers of meat that cover thick slices of toasted bread. Most people drizzle cheese sauce over the sandwich. If that sounds like too much sandwich for you, then order a pony shoe sandwich. It's about half the size.
That is funny.
Yes, it is. So in Indiana, we're going to have the sugar cream pie. In the 1800s, Quaker and Shaker settlers, German and Dutch immigrants, and Appalachian pioneers moved to Indiana, bringing with them a wide array of recipes and traditions. Food historians say sugar cream pie originated in the Amish and Shaker communities. Some Indianans report finding recipes for the sweet pie in old family cookbooks dating back to 1816. Sugar cream pie began with a simple pie shell. For a filling, people creamed butter with maple or brown sugar and a bit of flour, mixed it with vanilla-flavored cream, poured it into the pie shell, and then baked it. State officials named it the official pie of Indiana in 2009.
I have to tell you, I didn't know states had official pies. Birds,
well,
songs.
You know, I'll have to look that up. Maybe that'll be the next talk or maybe another talk if every state has an official pie. That would be interesting to know, too.
That would be.
So now we're going to go to Iowa. In Iowa, you're going to find stuffed Iowa chops. There's a Bob dish if anybody
indeed.
Ever was.
I like it.
The state of Iowa is the number one pork-producing state in the U.S. There's another one I didn't know. And they raise nearly one-third of the nation's hogs. The The Iowa chop is a thick center cut of pork, and when it's breaded and stuffed, the Iowa pork chop becomes a favorite dish across the Hawkeye State. Traditionally, people cut a pocket in the pork chops, then brown them, stuff them with a mixture of onion, apple, corn, breadcrumbs, and seasonings, brush them with a sauce, and bake them. The finishing touch is a covering of a delectable sauce. Many Iowans consider stuffed pork chops to be the ideal comfort food. Well, boy,
I think I do too.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So let's move on to Kansas. So Kansas has homemade chicken and noodles. Simple, hearty, and filling. Homemade chicken and noodles are a favorite traditional dish in Kansas. Home cooks are quick to point out, though, that this is not a chicken and noodle soup, but a classic meal that just about everybody grew up with. It's a dish that's interwoven through the state's food traditions, so much so that the little cafes and big city restaurants alike serve it across the state. Many home cooks use recipes handed down from their grandmothers who claimed inspiration from their immigrant family members who settled in Kansas generations before. Now that's something I would definitely like to try. Never heard of it, which I guess throughout these that I was looking up, it's really surprising to me how many of these I have never heard of. And I guess maybe it could be that some of them are just known in the state. I don't know, but some of these I've definitely never heard of, like the next one. In Kentucky, their favorite is called the Burgoo. Never heard of that one. Some of the most traditional home cook favorites were born out of necessity. In Kentucky, cooks made burgoo, a stew made from whatever meat they could find. In modern times, this stew includes a delicious and very flavorful combination of vegetables, barbecue sauce, and spices, along with pork, mutton, chicken, or a fusion of two or more meats. Some say a Frenchman may have invented the stew during the Civil War. Vendors at the Kentucky Derby serve the burgoo, a tradition that dates back to the early 1800s.
Wow, that's really something.
And that sounds like an interesting dish, but again, never heard of it.
Starting to wish I bought the rabbit again, though.
Yeah. So now we're going to have my sister state. Woohoo! So this is a shout out, I guess, to my sister. She lives in Louisiana. And their favorite, of course, anybody could probably guess, is jambalaya. The culinary traditions in Louisiana are iconic, reaching the far corners of the globe. Jambalaya is a mainstay, and Louisianans are very particular about its preparation. Similar to Spanish paella, jambalaya is traditionally served in a big black pot. Cast iron, no doubt, is what I think. There are two different versions, Creole jambalaya and Cajun jambalaya. The Creole version adds tomatoes, while the Cajun version browns the meat before adding it to the pot. Home recipes use just about any locally available meat, including alligator, turtle, crawfish, duck, shrimp, or boar. But most cooks use chicken. Both versions add rice and a combination of bell pepper, celery, and onions. Now I'm not a big Creole person by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not a big Cajun person. Those flavors are just not my big flavors. But if I were to make it, I would probably put sausage in it. And I'm not talking about the ground sausage you buy in the roll. I'm talking about sausage you buy in the big link. I would probably cut that up to put it in. I think that would be good.
I think a deer sausage would be really good in that.
Yeah, deer sausage would probably be good, too.
Something local.
Yeah, that's true. So now we're going to go in Maine. And when I think of Maine, I think of blueberries, because that's the big state for blueberries. But evidently, their favorite is something called fiddleheads. That's something I've never heard of either, is fiddleheads. Many people, I'm sure, have heard of it.
I had.
Native Americans first harvested fiddleheads in Maine. Today, the fiddlehead harvest is a family tradition for many Mainers. A fiddlehead is the coiled tip of a young ostrich fern. The plant grows near the state's waterways, and harvest occurs in late April through early June. Locals say the taste of these coveted tips are a combination of mushroom, asparagus, and spinach. And I can tell you now, I love all three of those, so I would love the fiddlehead, I'm sure. Would love to try it. Those who try them say fiddleheads are more delicious than when properly prepared. Most cooks will boil them and serve them with butter and salt. Others prefer to pickle them in a variety of ways. So I really would like to try a fiddlehead. I just don't know where I'd get one at because I don't know that they would sell them here. But it sounds like it'd be delicious to me.
I'm sure like anything, you can order it on the internet.
Probably so. So now we're going to go to Maryland. And I think maybe after Maryland, we might be handing it off to Bob so he can do his segment. And then I'll come back next week and finish up my states.
Sure.
So Maryland, we have the Smith Island cake. Again, never heard of it, Smith Island cake. Grabbing a ferry is the only way to get to Smith Island, which is about 10 miles offshore in the Chesapeake Bay. It is here that the Smith Island cake was first prepared. Local historians say women first baked the multi-layered dessert in the 1800s, preparing it for the men who went out on oyster harvest in the fall. The cake consisted of 8 to 15 thin layers, and instead of buttercream frosting, people used fudge, which lasted longer than frosting.
Interesting.
Yeah. Baked by generations of families, the cake is a Maryland tradition. Some say they use recipes that they've tracked back to Welsh and English settlers in the late 1600s. So I'm going to end my segment with that. And next week when we come back, I'm going to go ahead and finish up these states so y'all can hear some more of the favorite delicious meals that people have as a favorite in our states here in the U.S. But for now, we're going to pass it over to Bob and see what he's got to talk about. It might bug me.
Well, now I'm really hungry, but might bug you. So the age-old question has come up, and we're going to talk about this today. Why aren't we eating more insects? I think this is a really good question, don't you?
No, I don't. I know why.
So for starters, we're going to start with something that sounds really great. Japanese giant hornets. These hornets, they can be up to 2 inches long. And what they do, there are actually hornet farmers or hunters that go out and find these hornets and they chase them into jars of clear alcohol. And they leave the hornets in this alcohol for up to 2 years until the clear alcohol actually turns sort of an umber color when the venom and the other juices from the hornets come out into the alcohol. And then they drink it, and they say it's a lot like a whiskey. Some people compare it to ash and salt kind of flavor, but it's very popular.
Who wants to drink ash and salt? Tell me.
Well,
come on, call in. Tell me.
I think I hear crickets. Oh, I'm sorry. That was really bad. Speaking of crickets, I have actually eaten some protein bars made with cricket flour, and they're actually quite good. There's no unusual taste. I can't say a cricket tastes like chicken. They're really, really super high in protein, though, and they're really good for you. And here in the West, we're the only people on Earth really not eating insects on a regular basis. So it's definitely an up-and-coming thing. We just seem to resist doing it, I guess, because we think that they're dirty or gross or something. But then we go to the bar and slurp down a nice slippery oyster.
I don't think we resist doing it. I think we avoid doing it. Big difference there.
We just tend to shy away from anything that might once have crawled, hopped, or hovered over a picnic blanket.
That's right.
It's historical and attributable in part to the inhospitable life that some of us lived early on in this continent. So Europe is home to just 2% of the world's edible insects, and its specimens don't grow as large and thus aren't quite worth hunting. But in most other places, equatorial tropics, there are plenty of insects to eat there. So the Europeans, by extension, European settlers in North America, never had a bug-eating tradition. Indeed, they largely considered insects dirty and drawn to decay, signifiers and carriers of disease, which a lot of them are not. We call them pests, the word whose Latin root means plague. So I guess that would be a good reason to not eat them. although the Bible condones the consumption of certain bugs, John the Baptist survived on locusts in the desert. Every swarming thing that swarms on the ground is detestable. It shall not be eaten, is also part of what's said in the Bible. But still, they're eaten in most parts of the world, which is very interesting. None of that, however, has stopped entrepreneurs in the West from promoting bugs as a superfood. Very rich in protein, ecologically sustainable, appealing to health obsessive people and environmentalists alike. In the past few years, a number of startups dedicated to entomology and the human consumption of bugs, including exoprotein bars, and that's the one that I've tried, exoprotein. They were really, really good, I have to say, and I should probably get some more. Other companies like Biddy Foods, Aspire Food Group, and Hargle Food Tech have raised millions of dollars in venture capital. Silicon Valley officials have been spotted stocking up on snacks and treats based on the flour of roasted and pulverized crickets, which again goes back to the Exo bar. Now I'm curious if you could make a cake out of cricket flour.
If I can make a cake?
Yeah.
No.
The American market for edible insects exceeds, are you ready for this, $55 million only in 2017. But is projected to increase by more than 43% by 2024, according to research. So I think that we're going to be seeing more bugs. I'm not sure we could make a bug burger. I think you'd probably need a lot of insects for that.
You go ahead.
But the insects, of course, that these companies are selling no longer look like insects. It's because while their minds may have evolved, our eyes have not. So. Since you don't want to just put a bug in your mouth or in your ear. to many, the presence of cold-blooded hexapods on a plate is still not a source of something that you want to eat. So it's a struggle to get that past people. But by the time that they really get this done, you're not even going to know you're eating insects. You're going to be treating them like potato chips. Mm-hmm. At least that's what some people say. Stephen Colbert observed on a late show in July, after watching the Harlem-based chef and restaurateur Marcus Samuelson dredge chicken in cricket flour and drop it in sizzling oil, deep frying it is what makes it American. So see there, you can even make chicken breasts with the cricket flour, not just cakes, and not just protein bars. And again, yeah. I have a feeling you're not going to be dredging any chicken in cricket flour anytime soon. But it's actually a way to persuade the public to do this and to try it, because it's an anticipated $1 billion market worldwide. It's reliant on camouflaged products. So you're not seeing a cricket, you're not seeing some of these beetles and larvae. Although the European Union, I just read, has recently just made the wax worms suitable for human consumption. They've approved them. So they're now on the approved food list. Not sure I want to go out to McDonald's and get a waxworm burger.
I think the most the approved list would get is fish. The fish can have the waxworms. I'll put them on a hook and go fishing with them.
and then dredge the fish in the cricket flour?
Yes.
When you fry it?
No.
No.
Okay. No.
Well, I tried.
Well, the other thing, too, about cricket flour, I don't know this to be a fact, but, you know, crickets are everywhere. Yes. Crickets are, you can... It's just ridiculous. But again, they can make the cricket flour out of this much cheaper, inexpensive, more available material. But I can promise you it's going to cost more than regular flour. And I just think that's terrible.
And they do. The protein bars are not cheap.
Yeah.
Hopefully they will be at some point as this becomes more mainstream. It's just hard to say. But, you know, of course, we already do eat insects unintentionally, possibly as much as 2 pounds a year. Stray fragments wind up in things like peanut butter, packages of frozen broccoli, and there's an allowable amount of bugs in our...
No, there's not!
according to the FDA.
Yeah, they accidentally end up there. That is not allowable. That's accident.
It is accidental. Yeah. We willingly eat honey, each teaspoonful of which represents a lifetime of regurgitations of 50 bees. Yet back in 2012, when Starbucks was discovered to be using a natural food coloring derived from crushed cochineals to dye its strawberry frappuccinos red, there was an outcry, and the company switched to tomato-based colorings.
Didn't know.
So it's already out there and happening. You just probably don't know about it.
Yeah.
And from a scientific standpoint, our rejection of bugs as food is illogical. Insects share many characteristics with crustaceans, crabs, lobsters, etc. Lobsters were actually related to the cockroach. So
not there.
And those things are coveted and esteemed. Both members of the phylum Arthropoda. Again, that's lobsters and things like that. They consider, in a book called Consider the Lobster, David Foster Wallace, it's actually an essay, I apologize, not a book, noted that lobsters are basically giant sea insects. And he's right. As I was just saying, they're really related to cockroaches. So next time you go out there and have that lobster po' boy, just think about
that.
Well,
here's the thing. A lobster is a solid white meat. I have stepped on a roach, and let me tell you, there is nothing solid inside of that roach.
But did you ever boil one first?
Oh, stop it.
The people in Maine refer to lobsters as bugs.
Oh,
so
God.
You just never know. But like insects today, lobsters were once dismissed as bottom feeders, too abundant to be treasured. People didn't even want to eat them because they thought they were just junk. In colonial times, indentured servants and prison inmates were fed them almost daily.
Wow.
Because they were considered to be trash food. And given to prisoners, I guess that would be a good reason to get arrested back in colonial days.
Yeah.
Only the arrival of cross-country railroad in the 19th century, when non-coastal dwellers had a chance to taste canned lobster, did they become an exotic, desirable dish. So I guess, can bugs undergo a similar makeover? Maybe. Some 2,100 insect species worldwide have been identified as edible.
Okay, back to the lobster. Let me just make another statement about that. So you see, back in the day, they figured that to be trash food, which meant it was worth nothing. So they fed it to the prisoners, and then they discovered it was delicious. So what did they do? They now charge us $25 a pound for the lobster because it's no longer trash food. So this is the perfect example of what I'm talking about, where there are foods that are more readily available, and because of the popularity, they charge an exorbitant amount for it, even though it shouldn't cost that much. Okay, I'm done with my rant.
But you're not wrong.
Yeah.
80% of the world already eats crickets on a daily basis. To get back to our wonderful little chirpy friends, Jiminy and friends. But they're very sustainable because the same amount of water, for example, that's used to create 5 pounds of beef protein from raising cows, that same amount of water will create 60 pounds of cricket protein.
Oh, yeah, see?
So they're very sustainable. It's much better for the planet. They produce very little greenhouse gas compared especially to something like a cow, which has become a big deal lately. So it's just, the idea of introducing insects into the Western diet would once have been just improbable, but now it seems like it might actually happen. Maybe not in your household or my household.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I've said I'll try anything. I don't know.
Uh-oh. Yeah, maybe we found something you're not going to try.
I don't know. Of course, you know, I have seen, I think it's at Disney, in Epcot, and maybe even at Busch Gardens, I don't remember. But they sell lollipops that are clear that
yes.
have an insect inside
yes.
of them.
Yes, they
mm-hmm.
do.
Yes.
Crickets produce, I was just talking about this, crickets produce 1% of the greenhouse gas the cows produce. So environmentally, with the whole global warming issue and those things that are on the table right now, I think things like this are really coming into their own.
Yeah,
which is a little strange, but
mm-hmm.
So how and why do you want to cook with bugs? And there are three chefs that wrote a very interesting article about this. Again, saying we're quick to down slippery oysters, stinking cheese like blue cheeses and Roqueforts and hot dogs made out of things that I don't even want to discuss right now because that's just,
yeah.
I don't know. If you know what's in a hot dog, you'll probably never eat one again, so don't look.
Oh, I don't know. It's never stopped me, but anyway. I just use that old not there, not there.
Not there. Yeah. Exactly. But so only in the West have we really resisted these things. And to make good on the suggestion that we should, we asked three chefs around the world to submit their own recipes for insect dishes that can be made at home, assuming you have the stomach for it, along with the correct, somewhat chefy tools. What tools do you need to cook with bugs? I'm really not sure about that. Some kind of sticky tape, perhaps, to catch them. And, of course, you have to have the right bugs, not just anything running around your house. So, a note on the last part, Thailand, unique stocks, stocks an extensive collection of insects for cooking purposes in some of their stores, including dehydrated silkworm pupae, highlighted in one of the dishes that we're going to talk about in a minute. And there's a Maine-based company called Entosense who sells online also insects for human consumption and for cooking purposes. You need to look that one up.
I'm sitting here thinking about it, and I'm not going to say for sure, but I may order some things to try just to talk about on the show so I can let you guys know what I think. And of course, anybody who tries anything, I always wonder why there's even critics or taste testers, because somebody who loves a movie, another one's going to hate it. Somebody who loves one dish or one food, another one's going to hate it. So to judge a food or to judge a movie to me makes no sense whatsoever, because I can name plenty of movies that Bob loves that I think are, I don't want to say stupid, but I think stupid. So it's
great,
the same thing. It's a matter of opinion. It really is. Just like I love my Lifetime movies and my romance movies and Bob, no.
It's because there are three plots in the entire
realm
of 5,000 movies.
I knew he would say it. But anyway, so it goes back to that. I don't know why they have critics or why they have taste testers or anything like that, because there's always, always going to be one that hates it, one that loves it, one that thinks it's okay, you know. Mm-hmm. So to me, there's just, there's no judging anything.
It's worth a try. But you can go to the website Mercy Mercado, which is the best site apparently for procuring grasshoppers and gusano worms. That's MercyMercado. And there's another site, Entomo Farms. That's Entomo Farms. And they're a provider of cricket and mealworm products.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, it sounds great, doesn't it?
I don't know yet.
Moving on.
Yeah.
So the first recipe we're coming across here is locusts simmered in soy sauce and mirin. You don't sound thrilled by this.
Yeah.
So Wakuna, a Japanese seafood chain from powerhouse restaurant operator Tokyo Ichiban Foods. I've heard of them. I'm sure you probably have too. I believe they make a frozen food product, in fact, but they have a location in New York. But one of his formative cooking experiences is bug-centric. So learning how to make different dishes, including these locusts, which is a mixture of soy sauce and mirin again. He said it's his childhood memory dish. So let's see what's in this thing. So we have a pound of locusts. And there's actually a photo on the internet of them on a plate. They just look delicious, don't they, Mel?
Oh my gosh.
1 pound of locusts, 7 tablespoons of soy sauce, 2 cups of sake. I can get into the sake. Maybe we need a little more of that for this dish. 2 cups of sugar and 1 cup of mirin. And you boil the insects for 1 minute and then drain them in cold water. Tear off the legs because they're tough and hard to chew. I wish we had video here so you could see poor Mel's face.
Oh, God.
Put the locusts in a deep pan or a wok and stir fry them for about 10 minutes or until all the moisture is gone from them. Pour in the soy sauce, the sake, sugar, and mix well and simmer for 2 hours or until the oil moisture is gone again. And the locusts actually get candied. Which actually sounds pretty good now that I'm really thinking about that. Candied locusts. I could probably try that.
I don't know.
I'd give it a shot. You reduce that until the insects are dry and add the mirin and stir well. And to keep it from burning, because if you don't stir it, that's what's going to happen.
I just have to say, if my brother is listening out there, buddy, the picture of these locusts remind me of when we were growing up at home, those black grasshoppers with the yellow line that they had, only no yellow line and kind of orangish red legs, but they're shaped exactly, as soon as I looked at them, that's what I thought of. So that's what they look like. Doesn't that sound enticing?
Moving on to silkworm pupae with cellophane noodles.
Now yeah, pupae. Pupae, that's it. Puke. Pupe.
Not puke.
Oh, yeah. Pupae. Yeah. They just misspelled it. It's puke. That's what it is.
This actually is a Korean dish. Chef Joseph. Chef Joseph Yoon created an insect-studded riff, a classic cellophane noodle dish. Yoon is the executive chef of Brooklyn Bugs, a New York-based company focused on eating insects, which launched a culinary festival in 2017. Silkworm pupae are a common food throughout Korea, he said.
Pupae.
Stop it. Where many locals eat them as children. So see, this is the thing. If you started doing this when you were a child, this would be perfectly normal to you, and we wouldn't be laughing about it. It would be a normal dish.
You mean they don't eat the insects as children? The insects aren't children?
Not insect. Oh my goodness, where did we go wrong here? When they discover what it is that they're eating at an older age, it becomes disgusting to them. But when you do it starting when you're young, it's just normal. It's just what you have. Mm-hmm. He said the silkworm pupae taste a bit like corn nuts with a dry, grainy flavor, which I really love corn nuts. So
they discover when they're older that it's disgusting because you're smarter when you get older. Then you just go, yeah, that's no good.
Okay, that's it. So if you want to make these, you're going to need a pound of Korean cellophane noodles, 2 cups of dried silkworm pupae. I'm not sure how many that is exactly, but 2 cups anyway. 3/4 cups of soy sauce, 6 tablespoons of mirin again, 6 tablespoons of sake. Now we're getting there. We're upping the sake content, so that's a good thing. 2 tablespoons of chili oil, 5 cloves of garlic, 1 teaspoon of ginger, salt and pepper to taste. Not sure how much salt and pepper you have to put on silkworm pupae to make it taste good. An onion, finely sliced lengthwise and cut in half. A red bell pepper, also finely sliced. Tablespoon of vegetable oil, 4 teaspoons of sesame oil, and 2 carrots julienned. Handful of spinach, and 6 to 10 ounces of shiitake mushroom cut in slices. I gotta tell you, this is starting to sound pretty good. Except maybe for
the
silkworm.
Yeah, you're gonna hear crickets over here.
Crickets, here we go again. Comedian in every group. So you soak these dried silkworm pupae, which I believe you can get on one of those internet sites I mentioned, in this mixture to rehydrate them, because they're dried. So you need 1/2 cup of soy sauce, 1/4 cup of mirin, 1/4 cup sake, maybe more, 2 tablespoons of chili oil, 2 minced garlic cloves, 1 teaspoon of minced ginger, and a little water to cover them, about 1/2 cup, and should be done for a couple of hours at least, or preferably overnight. I think all these spices and flavorings may be taking away from the pupae.
Then why eat it?
Well, you may want to put less spice. I don't know. Just try them. So you place 1 pound of the pupae in boiling water and mix thoroughly to avoid clumping. Cook for 5 to 6 minutes until they're al dente.
Al dente?
It's not pasta. It's bugs. Place in a colander and run under cold water until cool. Take scissors and cut into eighths. So you have to cut each one into eighths. That could take some time, I would think. Maybe you could throw them in a food processor. I don't know, maybe that's too much. Add 1/4 cup of soy sauce, 2 tablespoons of mirin, 2 tablespoons of sake, 2 minced garlic cloves, salt and pepper again, and mix thoroughly. I believe they were talking about the noodles here. I apologize, I am so sorry. Yep, that's what we're doing. We're talking about the noodles that you're cutting into eighths. So that makes more sense. I can live with this now. And then you're going to add 2 tablespoons of sesame oil and mix one final time. And while the noodles are cooking, preheat a pan over medium-high heat and add vegetable oil. Add the onions, the red bell pepper, and the carrots, pinch of salt and pepper, and cook until slightly caramelized and set that aside. That sounds really good. Mm. Blanch a handful of spinach, wring it dry, drizzle with sesame oil and a pinch of salt. And then you're going to cook the shiitake mushrooms in a preheated pan with vegetable oil over medium-high heat. I don't like all this vegetable oil.
Yeah.
I think we need to switch this up for olive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is just too much. I'm not a big fan of vegetable oils. add a little salt and pepper to that. Let the moisture evaporate from the mushrooms so they cook down. Add a minced garlic clove, a dash of soy sauce, and sesame oil. There are a lot of garlic cloves, and you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how much there is there.
I do love garlic, so.
Well, I do, too. Then you're going to combine the noodles and vegetables until they're evenly mixed. And then you're going to strain your silkworm pupae and mix it with the noodles. And you can eat it at room temperature if you want to, or you can heat it immediately before serving it.
You know, if I'm going to put so much effort into a dish, I really would like to know that I'm going to actually want to eat it when it's done. I don't know. I don't know if I want to eat it when it's done.
I think it would be interesting to try it. It's just, maybe it's just me. So lastly, we're going to do one more charred avocado. Here I go again. Charred avocado tartare with ant larvae and herb chips. And again, if you could just see Mel's face right now. So this is from Chef George Vallejo, co-founder of Acclaimed Mexico City Restaurant. Who created his popular charred avocado tartare with ant larvae to showcase what he believes to be the most iconic ingredients in Mexico.
My stomach is churning, and not in a good way.
Avocados and insects, the most iconic ingredients in Mexico. I've been to Mexico. I never saw insects on any restaurant menu there, which is interesting.
We just stayed away from those.
Maybe that's what it was. We've spent too much time in the tequila factory with roosters.
That's right. Yes.
So his goal was to uplift the reemergence, reimagining of his country's familiar guacamole and chips. And to do so, he sources Quintanilles escamoles, which is that's the ant larvae that he's putting in these things. So let's see what this recipe looks like. This should be interesting. So first he starts with a sherry vinaigrette, which is 3.5 tablespoons of sherry vinegar, 3.5 tablespoons of olive oil, and a pinch of salt. Put the vinegar and salt in a bowl, beat with a whisk, and slowly add olive oil until the vinaigrette is emulsified. That sounds really good.
Yeah, on a salad.
Well, you could probably do this on a salad.
Yes,
I'm thinking about it. You could throw some ant larvae in there.
No.
Oh, okay. So then he adds a dehydrated sorrel leaf, 3.5 tablespoons of sorrel leaves only, 3.5 tablespoons of banana vinegar. I have not heard of banana vinegar.
Either.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Amazon.
That's another one I want to look up.
Probably Amazon.
Or you can use a sherry vinegar if you prefer. And you put the vinegar and sorrel leaves in a vacuum bag, seal it, and let stand for 3 hours until the leaves absorb the vinegar.
Wow.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wonder what you could do with a salad for that. You're going to have to try some of these things.
Yeah.
You drain that, and then you heat your oven to 210 degrees. Spread the leaves on a sheet pan lined with paper and bake for 1 hour. With fan at maximum speed. I guess they're talking about an oven fan. If you don't have a fan, bake for 2 hours. Okay,
You
can bake them for 1 hour if you have a fan in your oven, or for 2 hours if you don't.
I don't know. I don't know that I've seen an oven with a fan. That's odd. Okay.
Commercial, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's probably what it is. Then you remove the leaves and let them cool, and they should be crispy when they're done. So those are the chips, I believe, that we're forming here.
I'll eat those.
Now you're going to create a brown butter with chili and garlic butter, which is 9 tablespoons of butter. Can't go wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
2 tablespoons of garlic, 2 tablespoons of onion, 2 tablespoons of serrano chili peppers. Oh, yeah. Now we're talking.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting there. Heat the butter over medium heat in a pot until it reaches 275 degrees. Remove from heat. Let cool at room temperature. Once the impurities settle, slowly pour the liquid into another container without disturbing the sediment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all settled at the bottom. You just want the clear liquid on the top. Saute the garlic, onion, and serrano chilies with the clarified butter, taking care that the garlic does not burn. This is really sounding delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's kind of abandoning me here with fried kale. He's got a handful of kale and oil, and he's frying those leaves in that oil at 210 degrees and then draining and adding salt. I'm not
a
kale fan.
We've tried.
It has a bitterness to me that I just can't deal with. So.
We've tried kale chips, and I don't like them.
So I think we'd have to substitute something there, because kale is obviously the worst thing in this entire recipe.
Yeah.
Not the ant larva. It's the kale. And then there's some onion and spinach powders that we're going to put in. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit here. And for the plating, so you're going to use about 10 ounces of the ant larvae, 2 slices of avocado, 2.5 teaspoons of sherry vinaigrette, 2 serrano chilies, finely diced. Again, I'm loving me some serrano chilies. That's good stuff. 2.5 teaspoons of onion, finely diced, 5 teaspoons brown butter with chili and garlic, 2.5 teaspoons of dried kale. Again, going to have to substitute there. 2.5 teaspoons of dehydrated sorrel mushrooms, 3.5 tablespoons of onion powder, 3.5 spinach powder. He didn't say what, but I believe that's tablespoons as well. And then another serrano chili sliced, which I believe is for a garnish. Some lime zest, and a tablespoon of salt. And you're going to cut the avocado into cubes, place in a steel container with the onion, and burn them with a blowtorch.
Oh.
This is a presentation thing, which I'm sure would come out really cool. In a pan, melt the butter with chili and garlic and saute the ant larvae. Add the ant larvae to a bowl with avocado. Mix everything with the sherry vinaigrette. Place a metal ring and add avocado tartare and ant larvae in the center. Finish with fried kale, dehydrated sorrel, and slices of serrano pepper. That's for garnish and presentation. This would look really good, I'll bet. I'm sure this is a beautiful dish.
Mm-hmm.
Grate the lime zest on the tartare preparation and serve with the sorrel chips. I'm in. I would try this.
You know, I know we spoke to a wonderful chef at Crockett's, Aaron Ward. He's the head chef for that family of restaurants. And super, super nice guy. I love him to pieces.
Yeah, Aaron's a great guy.
I would like to ask him if he's ever tried insects in anything,
mm-hmm.
To see what his opinion is. Maybe we could ask him to call in on the show one morning and give us his opinion.
And if you're out there today, Aaron, shoot us a message.
Yeah, let us know. But anyway, we'll go on if you have anything else.
No, unfortunately, that's all I have. I know you're disappointed.
Yeah.
I can look for more of these for you.
No.
See what I can find. No?
No, okay. Well, that's okay. I mean, I really, especially a dish like that, I might be willing to try something like that. But
I have
to tell you guys something interesting. My husband, he's sitting here reading these recipes. And you would think he's been in the kitchen cooking and just knows all about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that ain't happening. I might know something, but I'm not actually doing it, let me tell you.
It's funny because Bob will be on Facebook and he'll see a recipe and he'll say, "Honey, look at this. We should make this." And I'll go, We should make this. Yes. Yes, we should.
Is there a mouse in your pocket?
Yeah. Yeah. Come in the kitchen with me, honey, and we'll make this. That's right.
I have been in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, we store things in there that I like to eat.
Yeah. I have to say, there's been a few times he's cooked some things, and they've actually come out wonderful. They really have. And I have to admit that I do like to be the master of the kitchen.
Yeah, you have no idea.
Yeah, if you ask any of my friends, my bestie, Amy, she'll tell you that when we've been to their house or they've come to our house, and I'm in the kitchen. Usually when we go to their house, I love to cook for people. I just love it. So I'll tell them, you know, I'll come over and make something. I'll go in the kitchen and start, and she'll come in and she'll say, "I know what the answer to this is, but I just have to ask you if you want any help."
You know in the movie 300 where the guy yells, "This is Sparta," and kicks the man into the pit? That's the look she gives you when you ask if you can help in the kitchen.
Yeah, so I don't like anybody in the kitchen with me when I am cooking. Now, on the opposing end of that, I think it would be very fun if I had grandchildren. That's a big hint to my son out there, Ronnie. If I had grandchildren, I really think my daughter is not going to have any children. She's just decided, which everybody has their own decision. That's fine. She's not going to have children. But for my son, if I had grandchildren, I think I would absolutely love to have them in the kitchen with me and teach them and show them and watch them try stuff. And I just, that would melt my heart. It absolutely would melt my heart. And when the day comes that he does have children, He's in the Coast Guard, so of course he goes all over the place. He's stationed for 4 years, then he moves on and moves on. And he's a career Coastie, so he'll be in the Coast Guard for many, many more years to come. But I can see myself making visits at least once a month once he has a baby. At least, if I could, it would be more often. But maybe in the future we could be traveling doing these podcasts, which I would love to do, just travel. So we would probably visit him more frequently if we had the freedom to travel and do these podcasts. So just a little hint out there for you, son. Once the grandbabies come, that's it. I'll be coming around. Not that I don't love you, because I do love you. You know that. But I will be visiting just as frequently as I can once that happens. So anyway, that's kind of my piece. But we definitely want to thank everybody so much for joining us on the show today. And again, if you have any questions, comments, anything at all, please text us or call us and leave us a message at 865-383-8347, and we will see you next Sunday.
Yep, and got some great podcasts coming up in the really near future, so stay tuned and check in on the website at www.epicwithmel.com. See you all next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.